You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hello, Cosmic Pizza Podcast, the show of all sorts that sorts all by serving up a slice of life. What is your order, please? I see. The special it is. We'll be there to deliver ASAP. Pizza Podcast, special delivery. Hello and welcome to the Cosmic Pizza Podcast. My name is Paul and I'm from the UK. With me today are my two co-hosts.
Dan in the UK.
And Sean in Canada.
Now, guys, just before Christmas, I was looking through my Facebook feed and I came across a post from Keith Johnson, a fellow ESO Network podcast host from the Earth Station Trek podcast, which I do listen to. And
thank you.
He says, having not listened to the latest one, but Keith put out a question there, and it said, is there any intelligent life in the universe, and what would it look like if there was? So I replied with a quick paragraph, and suddenly that turned into a conversation, and then it ended up with me and Keith deciding to come onto a podcast together so we can actually discuss it more meaningfully, because a couple of sentences here on here and there on Facebook wasn't doing it justice. So he agreed, and he's brought a couple of his fellow podcast hosts along with him. So without further ado, let's welcome Keith, Chuck, and Alan from the Earth Station Trek podcast. Say hello, guys.
Hello, guys.
How's it going?
Oh, gosh.
Come on, Charles. You can
always one that lets you down, isn't there?
There's always a walk this way person in the crowd. Walk this way, sir.
That's right. So let's start by you all telling us about yourselves, where you're from, and how the show came about, and why we're here today.
Hi, I'm Keith Johnson.
And I'm Charles Kelso.
And I'm Alan Seiler. Keith, I thought you were going to say, I'm Keith Johnson, and here's stuff about me.
And you know what? I think that Charles and Alan have to tell you more about how this came about, because Mike Faber, I think, approached Charles and Alan. I think, the fourth person. So I actually don't know all the background of how this group came about. Mike just texted me one day and said, hey, I got some folks together for a Star Trek podcast. You want to be part of it? I'm like, dude, seriously? Of course. So I think those guys know more about the genesis of this group than I do.
Chuck, take it away.
Yeah, well, initially, it was a pandemic project for me. I mean, Veronica, my wife, and I are puppeteers. We do a lot of puppet shows at conventions and theaters and libraries and things like that. But then the pandemic hit and we found ourselves crawling the walls and twiddling our thumbs at the house. And then the opportunity came up to do a Star Trek podcast, which we'd never done a podcast before, but it sounded much better than just sitting in the house and going crazy, waiting for theaters and things to open back up. So we got involved, and the ESO folks sort of put us together. We knew Alan. Alan ran Wholanta in Atlanta for a long time, which is the convention that we've done shows for a lot. And we hadn't met Keith yet, but now we've been doing the show now for 2 years. And Now we're talking every week about Star Trek.
You'd think we'd run out of things to say, but
they keep
never.
Making it. So we keep
right, exactly.
Charles, I don't think I knew that you had never done a podcast before.
Mm-mm, no, not before this one. We've got two now. So yeah, we're old pros now.
That's right.
That's it. Once they got you in, they just keeps going, doesn't it? You can't get out.
That's true.
That is the truth. Charles, you just like fell into it like you were a pro.
Well, good. Well, a lot of the stuff is stuff that I've done for puppet shows anyway.
True. Yeah.
A lot of editing and things like that. So right. It's not all new information, but I'd never done it in this format before.
Right.
Yeah.
You're an excellent host, by the way.
Well, thank you.
Real quickly, I knew Mike Faber. Oddly, I knew Mike Faber as a personal friend. I work in downtown Atlanta near what's called the CNN Center area, where the anybody who's been in Atlanta knows the world of Coca-Cola and Centennial Olympic Park is. And I work really just a couple of blocks from what is Dragon Con Central, which is the biggest science fiction fantasy comic book convention in the Southeast United States every year. Well, I've been listening to Mike's podcast, ESO Network podcast, for about a year. And one day, because I work so close to where Dragon Con is, I can literally just walk down to where the hotels are before I actually have to pay and just watch the crowds. And I'm walking through a food court one day late because I had a late lunch, and I hear these voices talking, and I recognize the voices before I see the faces. It was Bobby Nash, Mike Gordon, and Mike Faber, who I listened to on the podcast. So I walked up to them and said, "Are you guys from the ESO Network podcast?" And they said, "Yes." And I, incredibly random coincidence, bumped into them amongst thousands and thousands of Dragon Con people. And Mike and I became friends, and he knows that I've been watching Star Trek since I was 7 years old. My older brothers got me into it. And let's just say I'm past the mid-century mark. This is a truth. For over half a century, I have never gone more than 2 weeks without watching some version of Star Trek, ever. Period. And I go way back to the days before streaming, way back to the days even before VCR.
Yeah, back when you had to actually work for it.
Exactly.
You had to actually make some effort to see a show.
Yeah, but as we all remember, there used to be a time when, I hate to say it, in some ways it was almost better, because there was a time where Star Trek was always on some station. It was always right. On a local station, no matter what city you were in. So I was always able to watch Star Trek. It's my favorite science fiction property. Of course, I love all the other science fiction, so that's why Mike put me together with these guys. And I know Alan is a huge Doctor Who fan, which you can talk about. And Charles is all. You're a Doctor Who fan as well, Charles?
Yeah. I like Doctor Who. I like Star Trek, Stargate. I like them all.
So that's how we all got put together. And it's been really fun. It's the first podcast I've ever done as well. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It was my first one too. I'd been doing like a live YouTube show prior to, and that was another pandemic project. It was something to, you know, have something to do and to entertain people. And it was basically, it was an after show. After every new episode of Discovery, I would get two or three people on with me, and we would talk about that episode. So Thursday night at whatever time, 9 o'clock or whatever, that's when we would do it. And it ran for, I don't know, a year before Faber contacted me about doing the podcast. And he was like, I was like, "Oh, that's a great idea. I'm surprised there hasn't been a Star Trek podcast on your network before now." And he said, "Watching your YouTube show made me realize we should be doing a Trek podcast." And I was like, "Well, I'll take credit for that."
Awesome.
Right.
Thank you. Thank you.
And it's interesting too, because when we were first putting it together, there was a sort of a list of people that were interested, and we had a meeting with like a number of them. And there was almost Charles and Veronica, me, and a different fourth person. And then that fourth person never really showed up. And luckily, Keith came along. So that's how our little family got together.
Now it's hard to imagine.
I know.
different members.
Exactly right. Totally.
Oh, that's excellent. I mean, I didn't know any of that, the backstory, obviously, but
me either.
We keep it very private.
But it's amazing how podcast hosts can get together from not knowing each other originally to suddenly creating this podcast and making new friends and visiting. I mean, because even though me and Dan are only what is it, about 250 miles apart, which is in American terms, that's not far, but it's huge in the UK. It's
sure.
Four and a half hours of driving, and that's on a good day if you get past London. So it's a big effort to get together. We finally managed to meet each other last year for the first time after podcasting for quite a while. So
when we did our first anniversary and a Christmas episode at Chuck and Veronica's house, and that was the first time that we had all been together.
Mm-hmm.
We still haven't again since then.
Yes. Right.
Once was enough.
And we'll make that mistake again.
Yeah, then you realized why you stayed apart. Yeah. Yeah. But hopefully this year I'll get to see Sean. This is a trip I've been planning for a while to get over to Canada. And
I have 8 years in the making.
8 years in the making. Yeah, I've got relatives over there, so I can sort of make a trip there. But I'm still 8 hours away from him when I arrive in Toronto. So it's a bit. It's 8 hours. Well, it was 8 hours. Now you've moved closer though, haven't you, Sean?
No, it's still 8 hours.
It was bloody hell! No,
the way the geography works. Yeah,
it's still I thought you were a little bit closer. Yeah,
you would think so, but no.
So that's another flight, not necessarily driving. I'm not driving for 8 hours. Jeez.
And I'm working on my contortionist skills to get into his suitcase so I can get my way on there as well. Right. So
we'll put you in the hold. That'll be fine.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. That's fine.
So, okay. So let's talk about the subject about why we're here today, really. So Keith, it was your question originally. So what were you thinking when you put it out there? What are your thoughts about whether is there life out there? And
it was, I'll tell you what, it was really interesting. I was listening to, and it was an older one, but I was listening to a podcast that had to do with Deep Space Nine. And it was a group of three people who every week they just love Deep Space Nine. Like almost anyone who focuses on Deep Space Nine, it was all of these people's favorite Star Trek series. And they were just talking about, you know, every week, obviously Deep Space Nine, like any Star Trek or science fiction, is all about aliens and alien intelligence. You've got the Cardassian and the Ferengi and the Founders and so forth. And one day while they were talking about an episode of Deep Space Nine, they talked about communications and how they have subspace communications and so forth. And one of the hosts said, yeah, you know, because that subspace is really cool, because one of the reasons I'm so concerned about us ever detecting intelligent life is because all we have is radio. You know, it only travels so fast and only travels so far. And he says, so I wonder if we're ever going to be able to talk to other intelligent life, assuming they even use radio. And then one of the hosts, who's one of the most fervent lovers of Deep Space Nine, said, oh, come on, don't start that intelligent life in space stuff. You know, I don't believe in that. And I awesome. Got to tell you, I was genuinely stunned. I was genuinely stunned that a Star Trek fan doesn't believe in intelligent life in the universe. And I thought, wow, isn't that a requirement to like Star Trek and Star Wars and Babylon 5 and Firefly? Mm. And this guy fervently, and I mean fervently, believes that there's no chance of life in other planets.
Yeah.
Simultaneously, a coworker of mine and I were talking. This is about a week after that. And I love astronomy. I've been an astronomy nut since I was about 6-7 years old. And I was talking about all these new planets they were discovering. And there was a new star that was discovered in another solar system that's a red dwarf that had planets around it. Planets are what they call the Goldilocks zone, where liquid water can exist, blah, blah, blah. And I was talking to my coworker, really, really, really smart guy. And I said, boy, that's so cool if we can finally find evidence of life on other planets. And he goes, oh, come on, don't start that. You don't actually believe in life on other planets, do you? And then he gave me this huge lecture that God only created this one Earth for Christians. And I swear to goodness, he then started arguing with me that the Earth was only 10,000 years old.
Mm-hmm. Now, wow, that's very generous, because most of them say 6,000.
Yes. Now, before anybody who listens to either of our shows who may be religious, I don't think this is a problem. Before anybody ever writes letters to us or criticizing criticism of religion, let me state up front, I am the son of a minister. Raised in the church, I still consider myself a Christian, although I'm extremely open-minded. That's just the faith I was raised in. I believe in God. I also believe the universe is 13.8 billion years old. And so this guy just lectured me, and I was stunned. And he was just like, there's no way. And it can't be life on other planets, because God wouldn't have created life on other planets. And the Earth is only 10,000 years old. And then he started the whole thing about, is there intelligent life on other planets? Does that mean Jesus had to go and die on this other planet? I mean, it got really deep and crazy. Mm-hmm.
I've heard that before too.
Yeah. And this guy also likes Star Trek. So in the space of 2 weeks, I heard two different people who love Star Trek say that there's no chance of life, intelligent life in the universe. And I really wonder, do other science fiction fans love science fiction? Now, look, I don't, you know, do I believe that beings like the Q exist? Probably not. But I was stunned that anybody watching science fiction, especially intelligent science fiction like Trek, just refuses to believe that intelligent life could exist in the universe. Yeah. And I've heard it from all those things, from a scientific point of view, from a probability point of view, like, you know, intelligent life development is a one in a billion chance and it can never happen again. And absolutely, I've heard it from a religious point of view. And from different religions, as in the God I worship, whichever God or deity or pantheon I worship, only created, there's still that whole, even though we know the earth is no longer the center of the universe, from some theological people's views, there's still an earth-centered view of the universe, that this entire universe, which as far as we know is something like 90 billion light years wide minimum, was created just for us. And I'm kind of stunned that people even argue that, but trust me, I have a lot of people who argue that with me too. So that's where that whole conversation came from. And I just wondered, hey, do other people who love Star Trek and science fiction not believe in intelligent life in the universe?
You know, something that's really interesting about that is that I grew up, and I'm sure we all did, but I grew up from like the tiniest, youngest age, just watching science fiction and mm-hmm. all these kind of things, late night movies and Lost in Space and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And just unconditionally, I just accepted it as truth that there were people other places, you know, and it wasn't, it had nothing to do with a religious view or anything like that. It's just that it made sense that if there are, if you look up at the night sky and you see that many stars, there has got to be something else out there. And I went years and years and years and years. And then at some point, I don't remember where, but I guess it was on a news program or something, heard someone offhandedly mention that talking about this subject and then say, but, you know, of course, we have never, ever found any evidence of there being a planet anywhere else that has the capacity to support life as we know it. And I was like, what? How can that possibly be? Mm-hmm. That just blew my little tiny mind because I was like, there's got to be, you know, you can't make a show like Lost in Space. But, you know, but just from a factual slash logical, there's got to be planets out there. And knowing that we had never found any evidence of that existence shocked me. Like I couldn't comprehend that.
Yeah, it does make a big difference growing up with science fiction. It sort of changes your perspective. You think of Earth as a place among other places. I remember my grandmother, when I was watching Star Trek, she always used to say, oh, they're up in space. And I always thought it was so funny that she said up in space. It's like, well, they're out in space. You know? It's not up, you know? I mean, technically you go up to get there, but it's, you know, I guess it's a different mindset of think about the Earth as a place amongst a lot of other places, as opposed to thinking of Earth and then you go up to get to a planet, you know?
Right. I think a lot of it is also to do with, and I'm not saying that there are people less educated than others, but at the education that you get, I mean, at school we were taught physics for a start, and that sort of opened our minds to what actually is out in space and the sheer numbers of everything, you know, that there are billions of stars, there are galaxies, there are billions of galaxies, and there are billions of planets that could go around these things. Right. And it's hard to imagine those sort of numbers. When you look up the stars, you think, oh, I mean, we don't really see that many stars in the UK because we have a lot of light pollution. So, but we still see a lot of stars and think, wow, there's lots of stuff out there. It's only when you go to a place where there's no light pollution and you look up and go, holy cow, there is even more out there than you think. And you still can't see everything. And then when Hubble comes along and shows you all of the galaxies, all those dots are not stars anymore. They're galaxies and they have billions and billions and billions of suns in them, which could have planets that go around them in zones that are, you know, in a position to have life. Whether that life then becomes complex or not is another question. But it's just down to numbers and understanding that. And I think a lot of people go, oh, I was never going to go to physics at school. I don't really like it. And I say the same thing with what you guys would call math. There's a lot of math I don't get. You know, I just don't understand trigonometry. I don't understand percentages. I can't even work out percentages, for goodness sake. But, you know, it doesn't mean that I'm going to get... You sort of give up on it. You say, well, I'll get a computer to work it out for me or whatever. I've got a phone now. I can use that. I can work it out on my phone. But if you don't like a subject, you back away from it. And if people don't understand physics, and I think it's hard to understand in some respects when it's easier to believe something like the Earth is flat or, you know, God made this or whatever, it's easier to understand that happening than the actual physics of things getting together and making planets. And how does gravity work when we're all on a ball and it's pulling us in, yet there's a moon over there, but I can lift a pen off a floor. And you're telling me gravity can pull this down. So I am stronger than gravity, and yet gravity can pull a moon. Why isn't the moon falling into the earth by now? It's, you know, trying to understand all of that is very, very hard. And it's a very complex subject. But if you do get an idea of it, and you do get a grasp of it, and you're interested in it, and you look deeper into things, you can understand that there must be something out there. It's the sheer numbers of the thing. The billions of galaxies with billions of stars around them, with billions of planets that could do it. It can't be impossible. What I would say is it may not be, there's not another planet somewhere out there with six guys sat around a microphone talking about, oh, well, I wonder if there's anything out there.
There is in the mirror universe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but if you've got a beard, I mean, I used to have a goatee beard, a bit like Sean. Does that mean that your opposite doesn't have the beard? Are we actually then in the mirror universe? Is Sean in the mirror universe?
I hope so.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to having a full head of hair. That's the main thing. Yes.
Well, I think you said something very interesting, because I am a trained engineer. My college background is electrical engineering.
Ah, good.
And so I have taken more physics and math than anybody outside of a physics and math major. And I say that for a reason, however. I think it's how we get educated, both in school, and it's also how we get educated outside of school, in the home, for example. Mm-hmm. As I said, for example, my late father was a preacher, was a minister, and I was absolutely inculcated in the Christian religion, and you know, I went to church every Sunday. But you know what my parents weren't? My parents weren't ideologues. My parents were extremely open-minded. Basically, at the end of the day, my parents' biggest thing for me was be a good person. And they wanted me to be a Christian, which I was and am, but they taught me to be a good Christian. And they also valued education. So nothing I learned, and I mean nothing I learned, I would be reading about Hinduism and Buddhism. My parents never said, don't you read that stuff. Now, they didn't want me to turn Hindu or Muslim or something like that, but they didn't trip on that. So I was raised in a household where, even though I was taught to believe in a singular Christian God, the Son and the Holy Ghost, I was not taught to hate other thoughts. I was not taught to hate thought. So as I developed a belief in reading about the universe being 13.8 billion years old, and I would talk about that, say, at the dinner table, my parents never said, that's not possible. The Earth's only 10,000 years old. Because even my parents, having listened to me and my older brothers, who were both biology majors, talking about dinosaurs and stuff like that, they didn't sit there and start arguing with us about that. You know, they didn't say, and trust me, in my life, I've had people say this to me, honestly. I've said, okay, you can pull up a T-Rex bone and you can carbon date it. And carbon dating is not arguable. And you can date these bones with other types of things, and you can date uranium to, 65 million years ago old. I have literally had people tell me sincerely that God made all those things look older than they are. But the Earth is still 10,000 years old, but God just made it look like that. I'm like, but that makes no sense.
That's interesting, because the spin that I've always been told is that it's a trick of Satan, who is trying to get you to believe something other than what God wants you to believe.
Really?
Yeah, that's a really fascinating spin.
It's basically what I learned at school. Yeah, it's basically what I learned at school. You know, when you want to make a piece of paper look like it's older, you just take a bit of a mug of tea and just make some tea rings, and then just, put it on there, leave it there for about an hour. It looks older. It's right. That's the education I had. So, there you go.
Fascinating. And caught up in all that, and I say this again from a religious point of view, and I'm not going to just harp on religion, but caught up in that belief was, if all these other things can't be true, that the Earth is, 4 billion years old, then we also can't have life on other planets. And as you were saying, Paul, I'm not just going to harp on religion, but outside of religion, when people didn't even have it from a religious point of view, what happens is the science and the physics and the math become so complicated that it's hard, and people get confused. And it's just easy to say, well, I don't see it. Because as you said, when you think about life developing, most people say, I just can't conceive of how intelligent life can come into being on another planet, because it's a 1 in a billion chance here. But what happens is people don't think certain ways. For example, if you tell people the Earth is 4.5 billion years old, they don't comprehend what that really means. because even then they go, it doesn't seem long enough. And our minds don't really think in terms of the time spans that we're really talking about. Because if you think about that 4.5 billion years, well, that's like dozens and dozens of times longer than, say, the United States has been in existence. And what happens is when people get educated to think in broad pictures, what happens is they go from, in their minds, a person goes from, there's a barren earth, and then you're telling me all of a sudden life developed. And that's how their minds think. And our minds don't naturally think in terms of eons, millions of years, billions of years. So they will almost say that, Paul, you're telling me that life just came out of nowhere instantly. Well, no, we think life on Earth originated something like 2 billion years after the Earth was created. That's really fast, but 2 billion years? That's freaking long.
Okay.
And do you realize how many trillions of experiments the universe could have conducted on the early Earth before something got right? And people don't understand that. So when you talk about it, they think you're saying, oh, there was a barren Earth and then life was created. No, that's not what I'm saying. There was a barren Earth and for something like 2 billion years, literally trillions and trillions of experiments and chemical reorganizations took place. And finally, something started sticking. And it's hard to think in those terms.
Yes, but that's what the Christian mythos does say.
Yeah.
That there was a barren earth on day one, and then there was something else on day two, and then day whatever it was, boom, you have humans.
But you know what's not a boom? This promo for another podcast right here on the ESO Network.
Smooth.
Ever the professional.
Very.
I have one job, stuff. And I'm going to do it.
Thank you, Sigourney.
What will you do when your child asks?
What were Saturday morning cartoons?
What were Saturday morning cartoons? What's wrong with you?
Or will you handle it the right way?
Sit down, baby girl. Let me introduce you to my friend, Mark McCray.
Join Dan Klink and I on the Best Saturdays of Our Lives podcast as we take a unique behind-the-scenes look at the history and dynamics of animation with plenty of laughs along the way.
The Best Saturdays of Our Lives podcast is a proud member of the ESO Network.
So yeah, that's the whole creationism versus evolution argument, you know, that things didn't evolve over that a massive amount of time, that God snapped his fingers and there were humans and there were, you know, all these things, and that you didn't go through the process of dinosaurs and all this other kind of stuff. So I just think it's an interesting difference in the mindset.
Yeah, and given those time scales you're talking about, I mean, I think it's, and the scale of the universe, I think it's inevitable that it had to have happened somewhere else. Either is happening, has happened, or will happen somewhere, yeah. But I think it's unlikely that we'll ever know about it. I mean, the entire run of humanity could be a blip on the time scale of the universe, and we just, the odds of us blipping at the same time as someone else and close enough where we could, you know, get to a technological level where we could make contact, I think it's the odds are staggeringly against it.
I think you're right. I think, Dan, you made a point about you know, aliens could have already been here and found that we weren't ready.
Yeah, well, I mean, if we imagine that a race of aliens were technologically advanced, but only in the millions of years that the dinosaurs were roaming this planet, and they just saw this as a, you know, this is the safari, basically, you know, this is a set of animals, they came here, they thought it was very interesting, very nice, now I want to pop home for some tea, you know. Yeah, they thought, oh, nothing else is going to happen. Little did they realize 50 million years later a big comet's going to show up, and that's completely it, and we reset and do it all over again. Or even if they, you know, visited us up to the point where recorded history wasn't possible, you know, we've only been writing down our history for a small subset of our own, you know, human history, our human development. So if they arrived, observed a very early Homo erectus or anything like that before we could actually scribe anything down, there's no recording of it. We wouldn't have known. And because they thought we're so underdeveloped, they wouldn't have interacted. There's literally nothing. And to get to that point of being able to travel through the stars, there is an intellect behind that. We were talking about education, an intellect behind that that is so higher than what we are now. Even if we could speak in the same language, we might not necessarily have the same reference points. So there's so many staggering things and barriers to us even having communication. Even if a intelligent race plopped itself down right now, there is no guarantee that we could an intellectual conversation, even if we have radio, you know, even if we have the same ability.
Much of what you're saying is sort of the whole premise behind the ancient alien theory and, you know, Chariots of the Gods, Vandenakan, which was a huge fad. I hate to say fad, but it caught fire for, you know, a 5 minutes or so in the 70s. And that book was everywhere. Chariots of the Gods. You know, we were visited in ancient times by people from other places who we did not have the capacity to communicate with or to understand. And they left their mark on our planet in these various ways that we are only now deciphering.
Mm. Yeah. So Cylons, in other words.
Basically. Well, there was a paper just a few years ago, and I should have looked it up before this conversation. I didn't think about it. But discussing, I mean, they were looking at if a civilization had arisen prior to human beings, say 100 million years ago, how would we know? The concrete would be gone, plastics would be gone, buildings would be gone. You know, the earth just sort of consumes that stuff. Everything breaks down. How would we even know? They got down to point looking at like radioactive isotopes, like what would still be in existence that we could look at as evidence that civilization had existed prior to the evolution of human beings. And I mean, that's just here on Earth. That's not even trying to go somewhere else and look for it.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I read a. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, go on, Keith.
I read a. There's a fantasy series that I really love. It's called the Galactic Milu trilogy by Julian May, and it's about a future in which the human race has joined an interstellar federation of beings whose requirements for membership is that your planet has developed advanced psychic powers. And most of the members of this, Galactic Milu, or Milu, I don't know how you pronounce the M-I-L-I-E-U, the members of this, their planets have developed advanced psychic powers and real membership. It's like the Federation Star Trek, but more importantly, your planet should be kind of a gestalt where basically everybody on your planet should not only be psychic, but you should kind of be kind of like in a group mind, basically. And what happens in this thing is a scientist discovers time travel, but it's a very weird time travel. It only works in a region of France. And the time gate that scientists build is one way. It only goes to the past. And so what they do in this thing is the malcontents, the people who aren't happy in what we would call paradise, and sometimes criminals are sent to the past, 6 million years in the past. And what they find out when they go 6 million years in the past is that Earth was occupied by an alien race. And based on what, like you were saying, Charles, what they did though, is even before they knew there was an alien race, when people were sending humans 6 million years in the past, they only sent them back with materials that would degrade. So they only sent them back with advanced composites that would degrade so that they would leave no trace. Mm. And the fuel cells and everything they used, things were buried so that they wouldn't change the timeline. And that was actually the thing. So basically there was an entire civilization living in France 6 million years ago, humans and two different alien species. And there's no trace of them because pretty much everything they use and all the materials they built with have decayed. And we just can't tell.
That's an amazing, amazing concept. As some would say, that the French are still 6 million years behind. that's an interesting, a nice little interesting twist there, yeah. But I like, because I'm a big Isaac Asimov fan, and I've got all of his books up here, or a lot of his books up here, I should say. And the one of the first ones he wrote, which I'm trying to find as I look across the other, is The End of Eternity, which is about people who could travel through time and they could alter things and fix things and make sure that a certain peace happens and what have you. And one guy comes back. One guy falls in love with a woman who goes with him on the journey through time, which of course is not allowed. His boss finds out. He obviously wants to stop it and just say, you can't do that, you'll have to put it back. So he returns back to Earth in the 1930s, before mm-hmm. the first atomic experiments were going on, the first atomic bomb went off. And they arrive there, and when they arrive there, they suddenly realize that the machine that brought them back, they need to destroy it because people could come from the future and come back and find them, and it could alter things. So, you know, at the end of it, they destroy this machine, and they say, well, and the woman says, well, but what does that mean? Are we going to alter the course of history? And he says, no, he says, I've just read he says, all these people who can't come back and do things, and we can't go forwards and do it, all of that's going to stop. He said, yes, that's right. He goes, well, what's going to happen? He says, well, it's okay. I've just seen that the first atomic bomb has gone off. If we hadn't come back, that would have been stopped by the people who, you know, are, you know, running the show, if you like. They were going to come back and stop this atomic bomb going off. By us closing this portal, the atomic bomb has gone off, and everything will progress as it should. And hence the reason we are now in this universe. Also then sets up his own little universe so that all of his future books are set in this, if you like, a parallel universe to Earth, where it starts to diverge and then becomes his own universe of 10,000 years later, where spacefaring people and you know, there's a civilization out there. So it's a very clever way of, you know, saying that although it may not happen in our lifetime, I've now created this little universe on its own, that all of my history, future history, will be based on that fact.
We were on our show just last week. We were just talking about stuff like that. The whole, we were talking about, I think it was Voyager. We were talking about the whole thing about causality loops and time travel, where the thing that you think was an accident actually had to happen. You know, the whole thing where like 12 monkeys and stuff, where you're like, oh gosh, what caused that war? I'm going to go back in time to see what caused that war. And then it turns out you caused the war, and it turns out you always had to cause the war. So what you're saying there kind of reminds me of that, which is, it may not seem like it until you actually get into it, but what happened had to happen, was meant to happen, you know, that kind of thing. So that's what that kind of reminds me of, what you're saying that. You know, I was thinking about, and I think again, what Charles was saying, what we're saying about, and what Alan was saying about, you know, the possibility of life being created, you know, and we're talking about intelligent life. From both points of view, one thing I've always felt is, like, again, if you start from a religious point of view, for people who say, my God, or my deity, my pantheon, or whatever, they only created the earth and the universe for us. It literally makes no sense, if you worship a deity or deities, that they would create a universe that is, again, as far as we know, 90 billion light years wide, and we don't even know if that's the case. That's what we call the observable universe, what we think we can see. Trillions upon trillions upon trillions upon trillions of planets just for us. Because if you're a deity and you're doing what we would call magic and supernatural, then you know what? You could have made the earth flat. Just like in Tolkien, The Lord of the Rings, the world was flat at first. It was literally flat. If you believe in a god or deities who have supernatural powers, then you know what? The earth could be 10,000 years old. And they wouldn't care if you knew it, because it would be evidence of their power. And you know what? Like that episode of Star Trek with Dr. Crusher. Remember the episode of Star Trek with Dr. Crusher where she goes into an alternate universe, the universe keeps shrinking and people keep disappearing? Mm-hmm. Well, if you had true gods who wanted to show his or her or their power, they could make our universe literally as small as the Milky Way galaxy, which we used to think it was. They wouldn't have to make a universe 13.8 billion light years or 13.8 billion years old. Because why? You know, in other words, why would you make something that massive just for us 8 billion people? That literally makes no sense. And if you're a god and you're a god of creation and a god of life and a god of love, you're going to want to seed people throughout the entire universe. So as a person raised as a Christian, I have never found conflict with believing in a god and believing in life on other planets. Now, as a scientist and a science fiction lover, going back to like what you were saying, Charles, the math is the math. Okay, let's say intelligent life is a 1 in a billion chance, 1 in a billion to just survive. Well, we don't know, but there's somewhere between 200 billion and 400 billion stars in the Milky Way galaxy alone. That's just stars. And every one of those stars has from what we're now thinking, most stars have more than one planet. So we could easily have a trillion planets in the Milky Way. So let's say intelligent life to our level is a one in a billion chance. That still means that there could be like a million intelligent species just in our galaxy. And then there's trillions. So the odds, you can give us the slimmest odds possible to go from a single cell organism to an intelligent life. But when you multiply even those incredibly small odds by the trillions and trillions and trillions of planets in the universe, there's just no way we're the only ones. And, you know.
But what you're saying is, if it is just us, it's an awful waste of space.
Absolutely, literally. Yeah, it sounds like a hitchhiker guide something. Yeah, what a waste of space. It just doesn't make any sense that it's only us. The odds just don't play that way.
So how do we look for it?
Ooh,
yeah,
good question.
I mean, I think we're doing everything that's possible for us, mm-hmm. Hubble and things like that, and, you know, radio sweeps and all that kind of stuff, and high powered telescopes and all that. Mm-hmm. And then we have to get beyond that to mm-hmm. do more. You know, we have to discover warp drive, for instance. And, you know, I don't think that's an impossibility. I don't think it's in our immediate grasp, but I don't think it's impossible. So, you know, I mean, I think that we are doing what we can. And the other thing is, if another species is out there and is also looking, even if they manage to contact us because they have subspace radio or whatever, do we have the ability to respond? No, we don't. So, you know, we're kind of isolated for now. For now.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the physical size of the universe, the distances that you'd have to travel, even if we did hear a signal saying, help, or, you know, or whatever you do, don't make this sort of thing, you know. And then we hear it. I mean, by the time we've heard it, we've already lost. Right. We could have lost 100 years. You know, even if it was that close, it mm-hmm. could be a million years. And we said, well, there's nothing we can do about it. To reply now, we wouldn't be around to hear, you know, to know whether they got the reply and whether they replied back. So I think we are very much isolated in our own area. I think it could be that whatever created life on this planet, there could be one somewhere close by that, you know, if it was an asteroid that had some sort of biology on it that landed here and started life off, for example, that asteroid could still have seeded a couple of other planets pretty close by, maybe. Or if it's just one of those things that happened on this planet, then it could just happen on another planet in a similar circumstance. But whether it's close enough here for us to actually get in touch with people, and if there are people out there, it could just be that, you know, the closest we've got is a dinosaur planet, and we've got to wait another few billion years before we get around to anything that could theoretically possibly happen to us. We would have to assume that that planet wouldn't be struck by an asteroid that would kill everything, that it wouldn't, the sun wouldn't explode. It is a stable star. It's similar to our star. There is so many things that if one of those things doesn't work, it stops that train of, you know, of what could be. But it doesn't stop me from believing purely, as everybody said here now, the sheer numbers of it, there has to be something out there, whether they look like us or whether they don't. It's another question.
At this point, we're pretty much reliant on being visited.
Yes.
So mm-hmm. so once V gets here, then, you know, we'll load.
Yes.
Neil deGrasse Tyson has an analogy that I always love. He says, imagine that you take a pail to the beach, and you walk out into the ocean just to where the water comes up to your knees. And then you dip the pail in the water and you grab an entire pail of water and you look at it and you don't see any fish. And you conclude, therefore, there's no fish in the ocean.
Yeah.
And that's where we are. Because like what you were saying, Alan and Charles, about where we are, we've only had radio for 100 years. So that means that our own radio signals, even those we didn't intend to send in space from Marconi on through World War I, World War II, our radio signals have only traveled 100 light years. Well, if you do a globe, our radio signals have only traveled 100 light years radius from a globe around the Earth, only 100 light years. Our Milky Way galaxy is 100,000 light years from tip to tip. So even there, if you look at the volume of space, our own signals have only gone out to an incredibly ridiculously small percentage of just this galaxy. Right. So we really haven't broadcast ourselves out there. So a lot of times people go, well, how come nobody's answered us? Well, maybe there's not an intelligent species using radio only 100 light years from us. There's another 99,900 light years in just this galaxy and another 99,900 years for our radio signals to cover the galaxy. So again, as you said, our radio signals could hit another civilization 99,000 years from now.
If you think, though, I mean, there could be a civilization exactly like ours out there that is looking at these radiation signals thinking, hey, guys, look at this, look at this. There's three guys on this planet going and slapping each other. And then, oh, let's leave it a little bit longer before we get past these three huge guys. Right. And then a few years later, they go, have you seen this Monty Python crap? Jeez, what's going on this planet? And then they get to now and they're thinking, oh my God, we've got Boris Johnson and Trump. What the hell is going on here? You know, they're really making a mess of this. Do we really want to visit these people? I think we must. We'll give this one a pass. Let's get the next one.
You know, we reference Star Trek so much for a reason, because in Star Trek, as you know, at least with the Federation, they have the whole thing with the Prime Directive. And what you're saying is absolutely true, is the Federation, the humans, Vulcans, Andorians, Tellarites, and so forth, they do exactly what you say. They sit back and they look at these civilizations that are pre-warp. And those civilizations have no clue that there's other life out there. And they may never know if they don't develop warp, at least if they're in Federation space, because the rules are, well, they make exceptions all the time, like lithium on their planet or something. They're always breaking those rules. But the Federation rules are, until they independently are going to develop warp drive and get out in the space, we don't tell them that we exist. And so it absolutely could be possible if there was a hyper-intelligent species that literally look at us and go, no, they're not ready. I think
that's a good point, Keith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things about us, since we don't know anything else, we're by nature humans, we're egocentric and ethnocentric. And we think everything that does exist or will exist centers around, like, this is a personal pet peeve of mine, and I understand it. But almost every work of science fiction I've ever read or seen, movie, TV show, or book, always kind of says that when we humans go out into the galaxy, all the other races will go, oh, you humans are amazing. You guys are just so cool. Even though you're primitive, you have this spark in you. You have this curiosity. Honestly, what if we go out into space and they're like, God, you guys only live 100 years. You break down all kinds of ways, and you're really kind of dumb. Seriously, what if we go out there and we are not an impressive species?
Right.
That just came up on the most recent season of Star Trek Discovery, where they're dealing with a hyper-advanced species that didn't even recognize us as being sentient.
Yes.
Yes.
They were stepping on us like we were an anthill.
Yeah.
Right. Babylon 5 also dealt with that, with those elder gods, because they kind of didn't think of us as sentient. That still kind of freaks me out that somebody could think of me as not sentient, but there's debates now about our
speaking of egocentric.
Speak for yourself, Keith.
but it's very possible, you're right, that an intelligent species would just go, here's the thing, they would look at us and they would go, they have nothing we need. So many alien invasion movies where they come to Earth because they want our water or they want our gold. Trust me, there's so much. There's a couple of moons of Titan and a couple of moons of Saturn and Jupiter that have more ocean water on them than the Earth does. Our oceans are really small. They only go 7 miles deep. There are moons in our own solar system where the water goes dozens of kilometers deep. So like there's more water on some planets in our some moons in our solar systems on Earth. So there could be like those alien invasion movies, they come here because they want this and this. They could just go, they don't have anything we need. We got planets, we got water, we got gold, we got hydrogen, and they're primitive. And they're always fighting and they kill each other. Nah, they could literally say, nah.
That's the thing. if there is another species out there that has the capability of detecting us and contacting us, they would by definition have to be much more advanced than we are. So what's the incentive for them to, you know, reach out and say, what's up, humanity? I mean, unless they want to come in and you know, be beneficial to us or to, you know, foster us or whatever, or unless they're Santarans and they think that our planet is strategically located in a, in the war, their ongoing war with the Rutans, that's the only other reason that they would take us. But, you know, we can sustain them in a strategic point in their war that Saturn or Jupiter could not.
I thought about that. That's actually a very good point.
That's DC Comics for you.
Yeah. And also DC Comics, or at least the Justice League cartoon series, did that, where the Thanagarians, which are the people from the Hawkman people, that's exactly right. They were having a war and Earth was strategically placed. And they cared not a whit for humanity, other than the fact that Earth was a strategically placed planet that they wanted to rule because they needed it as a stop off in their war. Other than that, they were like, who cares?
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. There was a book I read recently. It was a science fiction author that he's not a big guy. He's obviously one of many thousands that are out there just self-publishing. And he put a story together where aliens had arrived on one of the moons of Jupiter, as Alan just said there. And again, they occupied it and said, well, you haven't occupied it, so we're going to occupy it, and it's ours. In fact, this is not Jupiter. It's you know, another name for the planet. They obviously named it their own name. Mm-hmm. And straight as you're reading it, you're thinking, well, yes, the arrogance of humans there to believe that Jupiter is ours. It's not ours. It's out there. It's anybody's. Who cares to come along and take it? I mean, why would we think it's ours? Why would we think we should move on to Mars when there could be another alien race out there that comes along and goes, oh no, we got this first, that's okay, thank you very much, you can stay where you are.
Especially given we couldn't go there if we wanted to.
Right.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. We're stuck here. What would we do? Yeah,
right. What would we do when we got there anyway?
Yes.
Right.
Plant potatoes. Yeah. Apparently
using poop. I think one thing that Charles also said, again, I think it's worth really thinking about revisiting, which is the whole thing about can they hear us? Because again, if you think about, our Earth is 4.5 billion years old. And if you, in our Milky Way galaxy, we think is almost as old as the universe. Our Milky Way galaxy is 13 billion years old, something like that. So basically, to dovetail on what Charles said, let's assume that there was another planet exactly like Earth, you know, 1,000 light years from us. And the solar system developed at about the same time as ours, 4.5 billion years ago. But if you think about it, if that solar system and that civilization developed just a tad bit faster than us, 0.1%, which is, you know, scientifically or, you know, mathematically insignificant, 0.1% is 1/1,000. If there was only 1/1,000th difference in their development and ours, you translate that over 4.5 billion years, that means they would be 4 million years ahead of us. Just, and they're only, that's only 0.1% difference in civilization growth. So as Charles, you're saying, they could have risen, dominated their entire section of the galaxy, never came this way, and fallen either through a war or a plague, or as you said, Paul, an asteroid that even they didn't have the ability to stop, or more likely, solar flares or something, like their sun was unstable, that entire civilization could have flamed out. And they could have sent us signals. And guess what? They sent us those signals. What were we doing? We're walking around on all fours as apes.
Yes.
They're gone. And we never saw them. We'll never know they existed. And how do we know that hasn't happened?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Or what if we receive it tomorrow and we realize this message that's come to us from a civilization that's in danger of being wiped out was sent a million years ago?
Yes.
Well, that's kind of
What do you do?
Yes.
You know,
that's a good chilling story for a science fiction story.
Let's get to writing.
What a message from a dying race that basically sent out a help us a million years ago.
Sean's got to shoot off, so we're just going to...
Yeah, I got to go and do some other things, but good to meet you guys.
Yes, nice to meet you.
Take care. Nice him.
And another thing, there's two other things that I always think about, which I'm not really troubled about intelligent life out there. The other thing is, notice what we keep talking about radio. Well, what if people have advanced to use something other than radio? You can use lasers, for example. That's one thing. You could use masers, microwaves, or that was actually the precursor to lasers. And another thing people don't always think about is when you send out a radio signal, you remember, you have to have a tuner. You know, for those, a lot of young kids don't know much about radio anymore because they don't listen to radio. they stream everything. But look at your radio dial, your AM and your FM radio dial. It's got dozens of gradations, and unless you tune it, you don't hear it. So what frequencies are we broadcasting on? Honestly, what if they just don't tune it? I mean, are other civilizations doing what we're doing? Are they scanning every conceivable radio and microwave frequency? Because if they don't listen on the bandwidth that we're transmitting on, they're not even going to notice the signals.
It's also the strength of those signals as well. I mean, it obviously gets weaker the further it goes. Mm-hmm. And of course, as it goes out, it doesn't go out in a straight line. It goes out in all directions. So the further it goes, there's less of the signal.
Absolutely. A certain distance from Earth, even if they were listening, you're right, the radio signals could get lost in the background radiation from the galaxy and they may not hear it. And what we have done, the SETI, you know, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI and other things, we make assumptions that this is the best guess. 99% of the universe is hydrogen. Hydrogen out in space emits a certain frequency of light, and hydrogen basically vibrates at a certain frequency. I think it's 1.21 centimeters or something like that. So basically, hydrogen that's just sitting, when you have clouds, hydrogen gas all throughout the universe, all throughout the galaxy, they emit radiation at this frequency. And since hydrogen is the most common element in the universe, 99% of the universe, and 9% of the universe is hydrogen, and you got all this hydrogen gas that just sits out there emitting on this frequency, what we have thought is, hey, since again, we have no way of knowing what frequencies other races would be communicating on, well, hydrogen in the galaxy, which is most of the material in the universe, transmit at this one, I think it's 1.21 centimeter frequency. Why don't we send our signals out at that same frequency? And the assumption is that another intelligent species would also say, how can we be sure that we're on a frequency that somebody else would be listening to? Oh, well, here's hydrogen, which already naturally transmits this frequency. Let's get on that. The assumption, therefore, is that any other intelligent species will also glom onto using hydrogen's natural frequency as the communications bandwidth. But what if they don't? Then what do we do? You know, again, you literally have to, and there's been criticism of SETI, because SETI's been around for several decades. And people, again, they say, well, if you guys, blah, 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 how come you haven't detected intelligent life? SETI gets almost no money. There's no funding, really, not for what they need. So they can't listen to every frequency. And you're talking frequency all the way down from like AM to the upper ends of the FM band. They don't listen to all that. So literally, probably 0.1% of the radio spectrum, we're even listening on. So we could actually be doing this. We could be, for those who don't, I'm doing my hands or my hands are missing each other. We could have whole civilizations that are just talking on different frequencies, or they may not even be using radio. They may be using laser beams. We just may not even be talking on the same type of radio. Mm-hmm. So how do we even do that?
Yeah.
One of my favorite Voyager episodes as well, the Timeless episode, when obviously he sends the message, but it's playing too fast. Just looking at that impressive vinyl collection at the back, you know, what if it's on the wrong RPM? You know, it's so so different. We come in peace, and that's it. Done.
Or maybe if we play it backwards, I don't know.
Well, then you just get satanic messages.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's true. That's very true.
We just watched Timeless last week, so love that episode.
It's such a good episode, and there's so many aspects to that as well. You know, they couldn't culturally conceive of another race of beings. They couldn't have that kind of background and would have thought of it that way. They saw it as a warning, a gift from the gods or a curse from the gods. And then that has to change as well. That our perception of what an intelligent creature is could also have to change. I mean, that also it plays into this, you know, how do we define intelligent life? You know, we are humans, yes, and our, you know, our basis is only us, but octopus, you look at an octopus and how they can use exactly the same tools. They can calculate, they can do all these things. Dolphins can communicate in certain ways. You know, even ants, you know, organize themselves in such a way that would be so much more advantageous perhaps to a spacefaring society, using, you know, cultures and working as a collective mind, as you mentioned from earlier, Keith. There are so many other ways for life to develop in an intelligent way. There's no way we could possibly say, well, this is the only particular way. You have to be two legs, you have to be upright, you have to be a mammal as the only way it works. You know, it's such a limiting concept.
That's very true. I think Charles and I were just talking about that as well, because another reason why I actually feel, based on what you just said, well, I feel very comforted on why we haven't discovered intelligent life is, to your point, we crawled out of the ocean and we mined metals and we mastered electricity and we can generate radio signals. There could be, just last 2 weeks ago, I think the James Webb Space Telescope discovered a couple of planets. Get this, these planets are something like the size of Neptune and they're ocean planets. Now think about that. Neptune is five times the size of Earth in diameter, which means it's like 120 times the size of Earth in volume. And most of that planet is ocean. Now think about that. Our oceans go 7 miles. This planet's ocean goes hundreds and hundreds of miles, and you could fit, its oceans could hold something like 100 Earths. What if the species on that planet never crawled out of their ocean, which means they will never master electricity. You can't do electricity in water. They will never alloy metals, because you can't alloy metals if they stay in water. And what that means is they could be incredibly beyond us in terms of intelligence, in terms of mathematics and poetry, but they never developed hard technology like electricity. They will never transmit a radio signal.
I find that hard to believe, because I've seen a film where whales created a spaceship and came to Earth. So, I mean, it can be done.
Yeah. There you go. At some point in time, you're going to have to get out of the ocean, even if you go back. And that's the problem. Mm. Like I've always, the series Enterprise, Star Trek Enterprise, there's a whole arc with the Zindi. And there's like what, 5-6 races that all developed on one planet, which is weird. I mean, there's humanoid, there's ape-like, insectoids, reptilians, there were avians, and there's an aquatic species. And the aquatic species still lives in water, and they cannot leave water. Their spaceships are literally filled with water, which tells you that the other species had to help them develop their ships, because again, you can't smelt metal underwater. You can't do electricity underwater if you only can live in water. So yeah, you can have whole, and I think it's actually very likely, you can have whole groups of planets out there where they just never left their oceans. And they're smarter than us. They're just not smart. They're not better than us in those technologies, but they could be doing math and song and poetry and their civilizations. They could be so far beyond us, but they will never talk to us.
Well, that's true. I mean, if you look at whales on Earth, they've mm-hmm. had communication across the entire planet long before we did.
Yes,
because their ability to speak through, you know, using the frequencies in the water means that they can communicate over vast oceans. Mm-hmm. Right. Whereas we need a cable and, like you say, electricity. Then we have to smelt metal to get the copper wire and all this business, and then get a telephone at one end and a telephone at the other end and two people talking at the same time. You have to get clocks so you know what time you're talking to each other, you know, just to speak across an ocean, where whales can just do it by shouting.
Yeah. I was watching a documentary recently, and I don't remember what species, if it was blue whales. I'm sure it wasn't humpbacks. It was one of the ones you always think of, whale song being a humpback thing, and I'm sure this must have been blue whales, that people who have studied their communication have detected an extraordinary number of different dialects, not just a vocabulary in their clicks and in their because the clicks that they make you know, are so loud that they travel, you know, the entire globe, you know, but in the vocabulary, there's a number of dialects from pods that live in wow. travel mainly in different areas of the world. And that's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can understand that in a humans doing that because yeah. you'd be stuck on a continent somewhere and
right.
maybe each speaks slightly differently for whatever reason, but yeah, it's unusual.
That's a point too, that even if we discovered a life form outside of our planet, would we recognize yeah. it as being sentient? I mean, even right. now we're learning yeah. more and more things about the life forms on our own planet that have been here our entire history. And like, wait, they're smarter than we thought. They communicate better than we thought. Like, mm-hmm. we might not be the only sentient species on this planet, much less in the universe. The way yes. we haven't figured that out yet.
That's very true. Because you're right. What does sentience actually mean?
Yeah.
Well, we could ask Dr. Maddox. He'll tell us. It's being self-aware, which means you're aware of yourself, which is like the stupidest line of dialogue ever in a Star Trek episode.
When I was when I was much younger, I got turned on to the Lensman series by mm-hmm. Doc Smith. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that. Mm-hmm. And there is one of the Lensmen, I forget the guy in the first Lensman book, goes to, I want to say it was Pluto. It was one of the outer planets, Neptune to Pluto. And it turns out there was an intelligent race of aliens. Well, I don't know if you call them aliens because they're on our planet. So there was another race of solar beings who lived on Pluto. And because it's so incredibly cold, they had developed some kind of thing where they lived partially in our dimension and partially in another dimension. And this is based on what you were just saying, Charles. And when the Lensman was talking to one of the races of the planet, this being is literally standing out with basically nothing but not even a coat on the surface of Pluto. And it's like 200 degrees below zero. And he could talk to the guy because the lens allows for telepathic communication. And then this other being is telling him that he has to go about his work. And the guy goes, what do you mean? And this being tells him what he does. And it makes no sense. It's just a series of images. And then the being says, well, let me show you what I do. He's basically like, let me show you my job. And the lensman stares at him. And all he can tell is the guy looks like he's kind of fading in and out. He's like, I literally don't know what you're doing. And the point of that was, had he not had the lens to allow telepathic communication, had he just been there in a spacesuit, what he would have seen is a flickering image of something that flickered in and out. And they never would have communicated. And even with the telepathy of the lens, he can't tell what that guy does. So without that telepathy, he never would have been able to determine that that was any kind of sentient being. It would have been like mm-hmm. the equivalent of swamp gas. No communication mm-hmm. possible. Like, I have no clue what they're doing or talking about.
Well, we're more closely related to, say, a blue whale or an octopus than we would be to any life form we discovered outside of our solar system. Mm-hmm. We can't have meaningful communication with a squid or an octopus. Right. We eat them, actually. You know, so I mean, the odds of actually finding something—not only finding a life form outside of our solar system, but one that we could have meaningful communication with—seems right. unlikely.
Well, we could just eat them too.
We probably would.
We probably will.
Yes. Well, they would eat us. It's kind of come down to, you know, survival and food, isn't it? Oh, we've traveled all this way to Earth, and we're so hungry.
And boy, are our arms tired.
Yeah. I also think, Charles, you said something very interesting about, I think you said, and someone else has said, there's also a conversation about not only would we have trouble communicating with them, but there's an absolute truth of what they care to communicate with us. You know, because again, we assume they want to. I read some books, and I think, I should know this. I think it was either Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle. And I think it might have been The Molten God's Eye, or it might have been Hammer to God's. Those who are reading, listening to this are screaming at me, forgive me. But basically, it was a series of science fiction books where Niven or Pournelle had postulated a universe where basically all the sentient races don't want to communicate because there was enough races that did go around conquering. And so the galactic civilizations basically spent most of their time hiding themselves from other races. They hid their energy signatures. They didn't transmit random radio waves. They might use directed laser beams. they did everything they could to make sure that no one could detect them. And they, it's kind of like, again, I know I referenced Star Trek a million times, but it's like so many episodes of Star Trek. We were talking about this again last week, where they go to a planet and the planet's, and that's actually not too many spoilers, but the Star Trek Prodigy, the premise of this one is there's a race of beings who were encountered by the Federation who are like, we don't want to know you guys. We never want to know you guys. And a matter of fact, knowing you has just effed up our civilization. And you see that so much in Star Trek, where they're like, we don't want to know you. And we kind of assume that everybody would want to talk to us. What if they just don't want to talk to us?
Yeah.
Yeah. They like say, you guys are a plague. They may have a worldwide theology that says, even if they exist, they're beneath us. Our gods say don't. They may be concerned about culture and contamination. Maybe they did meet another species a million years ago that didn't go well, and they're like, nah, just leave us alone. So we could be ringing up people, and they're just not answering the phone on top of that, which is kind of a depressing thought, but it's very true. Not everybody has to be like us, which is wanting to say, hello, hi. Some of them might be, nah.
So we keep hitting them up on the dating app, and they keep ghosting
us. Yeah, swipe, exactly. Swipe. Yeah.
There we are, all timber, arms wide, and it's just Shaka when the walls fell.
Because even on our planet, I talked about this in our show the other day, so if you look at the history of, say, Japan was an incredibly isolated, and I would say even xenophobic country for centuries. And Japan was very self-contained. Frankly, at that time, Imperial Japan, feudal Japan, kind of assumed they were superior to most other people. And they didn't even want to have much to do with the United States. And Japan didn't even really start relations with the United States until Commodore Perry literally steamed to Japan with a military convoy and pretty much forced them to talk to us. But other than that, they didn't care to. And that's just here on our own planet. Mm-hmm. So yeah, you can have whole species that just like say, dude, you guys got nothing that we want.
Those weird apes again.
they keep calling us. They keep calling us. Delete contact. Forget first contact. Delete it. Yeah.
They keep on talking about a warranty that I've got on a device that I own. I can't remember where I...
Oh dear. So I think, guys, that's we're gonna have to call it there, I think, because it's been a fantastic conversation, and as I say, halfway through that recording, I was listening and then realizing, hey, I'm not listening to Earth Station Track here, I'm actually part of this podcast, I better say something. It's fascinating. It's always great to listen to you guys. I love the show, and
it's really good.
Yeah, it is really one of the better ones on the network. Forget that pizza thing. I don't know what that pizza thing
is. Oh, terrible. Awful. Don't go that way.
Two guys who think they're from England put on funny accents and things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 300 miles apart, they can't speak the same language. Jesus.
Yeah, don't even know what they're talking about. They can't even communicate between the two of them. Yeah. That's the thing about the UK. You only have to go 45 minutes away from where you are, and you have a different accent. And a bread roll is called a different thing. So it could be a bread roll, a panini, it could be a bap, a balm, whatever. So, yeah, that's the thing about the UK. We're isolated amongst ourselves. So, yeah, that doesn't bode well for communicating through the stars.
It's so weird. I grew up in Texas, which covers two time zones and 780 miles from across this longest tip. And you can travel across that 700 miles and it's still pretty much Texans. I mean, the accents may be different. So, That's always weird. So when I came over to the East Coast and started hanging out and going to places like Pennsylvania, New York, where traveling 700 miles, you just travel several states. That's so weird.
Yes. Well, if you imagine tipping the UK on its side, that's 700 miles. So that's just shows how small we are. That's our height. Our width is a lot thinner.
Hey, last quick thing I want to say, I know we're about to leave is... We got the James Webb Space Telescope and other things out there. I do think that if we're lucky enough to live another 40, 50 years, those of us a certain age, I do think it's possible that in our lifetimes, or certainly our children's lifetime, we will detect life on other planets, but not intelligent life on other planets.
Yeah.
We may detect evidence of what we think might be microbes. You know, we may detect methane or oxygen in the air that indicates bacteria. I think it's entirely possible. We've discovered 3,000 exoplanets as of this recording. I think it's very possible in the next couple of decades we may find the proof of life on some planet, but it'll only be possibly microbes. Intelligent, I doubt it, but something, I think, very possible.
I think the images we're getting back at the moment from planets that we've detected, it just looks like a small blob, but it doesn't take much more. And with, like you say, 40 years or so from now, the technology could be there that we're picking up maybe streetlights that are lighting up the planet. Just like when we come from space, we look at the Earth, you can see areas of light and dark because there are cities there that are lighting up the night sky. Maybe hopefully tens of years time, we could be looking at a planet through a telescope based here and see that there are lights lighting up the night sky on a planet.
Wouldn't that be awesome? And wouldn't it be funny if we tune in and they're having like their own World Cup?
Yes, yeah. That's right. Yeah. Or New Year's Eve celebration, the whole place is going mad with fireworks and we're saying, look, they're having a war.
They're all just getting drunk. Oh, that'd be great, man. See aliens like puking in the street.
Then we can communicate with.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. There's a common language right there. Yeah. Like, I can't take three beers anymore. I'm getting that old three beers and I can't take I know where you're coming from, man. Yeah, yeah. Oh dear. But to end on a quote from Arthur C. Clarke, which I'm sure, I know Dan's heard, but I'm sure you guys must have heard as well. There are two possibilities that exist. Either we are alone in the universe or we are not. Both are equally terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And I think that sums it up really nicely. We're on our own. My goodness, that is frightening. But if there are other people out there as well, oh my God, that is frightening as well.
Yeah.
So I'd just like to thank you guys, Alan, Chuck and Keith, for coming onto the show. It's been fantastic having on, and it's been a great conversation. It's probably been one of our best recordings we've done, I think, Dan. I think we could go and say that. We've had a few good ones, but this is one of the better ones we've had.
Good. Thank you, guys. It's a great topic. So,
yes. Thank you, guys. And we get to go again with our podcast.
Yes. Mm. Yes. A return visit. Yeah, the return leg. Yeah.
we're going to have you guys on. Have you guys on Earth Station Trek, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm looking forward to that. Yeah. I mean, we've played at home. Now we've got to play away. So that's what we've got to do.
Without leaving our chair.
Yeah.
And I'm embarrassed to say this, but what was the topic again, Charles? I'm blanking.
The Doctors of Star Trek.
Oh, yes. So this was a subject I've done on another podcast many years ago. It was one of the first, in fact, it was the first podcast I was on. Mm. And we spoke about, I think there was only five back then.
Right.
There's a few more now. So, but this was a topic that we were going to talk about on Cosmic Petra at some point, but we hadn't really got round to it. And I thought, well, what a better opportunity. I can't think of a better opportunity than coming onto Earth Station Trek and talking about it. So,
cool.
Yeah, we just go through the Doctors and talk about them and what we think, who are our favorites and what have you. So,
that'd
be cool. Fun.
Sounds good.
So, thanks very much, guys, for coming onto the show.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
This was so enjoyable.
It's been an absolute pleasure. So, it just leaves me to say the grease in the box is cold. Dan, I've forgotten the ending. You'll have to do it.
The grease in the box is cold, just like the endless vast gaps in the universe that may not or may have life. And we hope you are full to the brim. So join us next time for another delicious slice of life here on the Cosmic Pizza Podcast.
We've been your deliverers today. Please leave a tip at the door by subscribing for future deliveries, rate and review our service, and we hope you come back for more helpings next time. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, and TikTok by searching for the Cosmic Pizza Podcast. If you'd like to send us an MP3 file, you can email us on cosmicpizzapodcast@gmail.com, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the Cosmic Pizza Podcast.
The
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.